From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Really, he invented the drive-through brothel, which is perfect for Los Angeles. He's sort of the Ray Kroc of prostitution.
Filmmaker Matt Turnauer was naturally intrigued when he first heard whispers about Scotty Bowers, who served as a Marine during World War II and then became the pimp to the stars, arranging gay liaisons out of a Hollywood gas station. Bowers was said to number Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor among his clients. When Turnauer learned that Bowers was not only alive, but still spry in his 90s, he made him the subject of his latest film. Turnauer tells us why he wants Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood to be more than a lurid tell-all. But first we banter. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
So lots of churn in Hollywood this week on issues about what is acceptable conduct, what is not, when did it happen, who knew what. And I'll start with James Gunn. I'm sure a lot of people are aware that James Gunn was fired by Disney over old tweets, which are really unfunny and tasteless, as James Gunn himself acknowledges. James Gunn made a lot of money for Disney by starting off the Guardians of the Galaxy films, which many people were skeptical that a movie with a talking raccoon was going to be all that, and it was all that and then some. So he did that. He did a sequel. He was supposed to do another one. They've now fired him. These are tweets dug up by Mike Cernovich, a right-wing guy who looks for opportunities to take down people like James Gunn, who has been critical of the Trump administration. And he found these terrible jokes, and Disney said they did not know these were a thing and fired him. And it has been a controversy that lingers days after it happened.
Right. And the reaction throughout Hollywood seems to be an interesting one because no one's defending the tweets. However, there is a sentiment I'm feeling that this may have been a step too far by Disney to just sever ties, zero tolerance for this. And the question is, why is someone who, by all accounts, is not this person anymore and has been gainfully employed and successful with Disney and has not exhibited this behavior, why can he not evolve as a person? And why is he being held in account for things that happened so long ago that he has apologized for profusely?
Well, now people are going to scrub old tweets that could get them in trouble. Obviously, that's happening. But, you know, it is Disney, so we understand that that is a brand. It's the only true brand in the entertainment business. Maybe Netflix and Pixar have that. But among the big studios, people don't say, I want to see a Fox movie this weekend, or I'll take the kids to the Warner Brothers movie. Disney is this brand. So being associated with this is not optimal. However, they are the ones who hired Roseanne, who had abundant recent tweets, and then acted shocked when she tweeted, again, tasteless material that was considered racist and unacceptable. So the position that they're taking is a little hard to sustain. Let me point to Jimmy Kimmel. He used to be pretty sexist and offensive and has evolved to a grown-up person who has made a lot of impassioned and informed political statements on TV. Is Disney going to discover that he used to be something else and say he can't have his show anymore? I mean, the standard doesn't seem too clear here.
Well, and that's what's going on in right-wing media circles right now, is that they are digging up a lot of these past comments by comedians. Trevor Noah has been targeted, The Daily Show host, for some comments he made about Aboriginal women. Sarah Silverman has been targeted. She has a Hulu show. There are others that are now in the sights here, and it's become kind of a hunting sport among certain corners of the media to go after these people. And Disney is giving these people ammunition by acting on that. And I've spoken to people at Disney, and they say, you know, it's unfortunate how this came to our attention, but it did come to our attention, and the overwhelming response from people contacting Disney was, why are you in business with this guy? This is abhorrent. Are you supporting the things he said? And that's why they acted. So it's a very touchy and difficult situation that I think a lot of studios are wondering how they should act, because this won't be the end of this.
Not by any means. I mean, again, the question is there a standard? Is there a time frame where you get somebody to say that was X number of years ago and I'm different? Can we have some clarity here? So I think Disney has gotten itself into a bit of a jam with this one. And I will say I'm quite confident James Gunn will work again because, you know, his talent has been established. And I think as we speak, people are trying to get hold of him. Let me turn to Amy Powell. She's been running TV operations at Paramount, making shows like 13 Reasons Why, the new Jack Ryan series with John Krasinski. She was fired. Why she was fired has somewhat become murky. Jim Giannopoulos, the head of the studio, sent out an all-staff memo saying she had made comments that were deemed inappropriate. And it has emerged that she, in discussing a reboot of First Wives Club, which was going to be with black characters, she said things like, black women are angry, black women don't like it when black men date white women, black men have mommy issues because they're raised by single women. There was an assistant listening in on this, and this was the only black person on the call, which I think is part of the problem here. White producer, white TV exec, a couple of other execs, you know, a group of white people talking about a group of black people in the show. She was fired. And initially, it was like, were these racist comments? Should she have been fired or sent to sensitivity training or whatever? Now, Paramount sources are saying, oh, the real reason she was fired was because she denied making the comments in the first place, whereas others on this call discussing this reboot of this show had said she did make these statements. Again, we have a little bit of an unclear message, but Amy Powell has certainly said that she is going to strike back against Paramount and not accept this.
Yeah, and she has already hired a lawyer, and she's claiming gender bias in her firing. It's a messy situation at Paramount, and it really goes to show that the era of anything goes type behavior on Hollywood studio lots is over. These studios are really cracking down. If there is any sign of inappropriate behavior and it gets reported to human resources, there is going to be an investigation. And in this case, the person was confronted with what was said about her. She denied it and they terminated her. So that, I just think that, the message that sends is you need to watch what you say. If you're going to make inappropriate comments, you're going to be held accountable.
But apparently, in certain situations at least, it is survivable. Chris Hardwick will be returning to Talking Dead after AMC looked into charges from his former girlfriend of abuse, a sexual assault and emotional abuse by Chloe Dykstra. So he at least will be back, although I think that too will be controversial. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new documentary, Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood, profiles Scotty Bowers, a good-looking Marine from the Midwest who made his way to L.A. after World War II and went to work at the Richfield gas station on the corner of Hollywood and Van Ness. Today it's a fire station, but standing on his deck in Laurel Canyon, Bowers remembers what it once was.
Jesus, look at that beautiful rainbow.
I created the rainbow in Hollywood.
The rainbow is a 5777 Hollywood Boulevard called Richfield. And that was a rainbow, that was the end of the rainbow for a lot of people. I mean, it's hard to believe, unless you were there, how much fun that gas station was. People disappearing up in the trailer and going in the washroom and doing this and that, the whole thing was fun.
In the 1940s and 50s, Richfield was the place to go for a discreet same-sex liaison. Scotty Bowers was the person to arrange it or provide services himself. Bowers names Hollywood legends among his clients: Charles Laughton, Cole Porter, Cary Grant, Spencer Tracy, and Katharine Hepburn, all people whose careers depended on maintaining a heterosexual public image. Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood was directed by Matt Turnauer, who has also made the documentaries Valentino, The Last Emperor, and Studio 54. I think I lost my innocence watching this movie. It's fairly graphic in many ways and tells a wild story of an era in the industry. I heard that you got into this through Gore Vidal.
Yes. So Gore Vidal was a friend. I was his literary executor. And Gore told me about this gentleman named Scotty. And he said, he's my pimp. And I've lost touch with him and I want to meet him again.
And did you sort of go, what?
Well, if you knew Gore, that wasn't such a shocking sentence. But I had heard about Scotty, not by name, for decades, really, in the course of reporting stories for Vanity Fair about that old Hollywood for instance. I did a story about Merv Griffin very late in his career, and he told me about this gas station on Hollywood Boulevard. You know, Merv lived a double life. He never really came out. But he said, you go there and get in trouble, which was the great euphemism.
Right.
Then it all came together one day where I was sitting with Vidal, and he said, there was this man, Scotty, and he had a gas station on Hollywood Boulevard, and it was a brothel. And I said, he's still around? He said, oh, yes. He lives in Laurel Canyon. And then they did reunite, and I met Scotty in Gore Vidal's living room and started the movie almost immediately.
And as he told Scotty, like, I want you to meet this guy who wants to do a film about you?
I don't know how it was set up. I think they had been reunited. You have to know that they met in 1948 at the Richfield gas station on Hollywood and Van Ness, which
right.
was up and running as a brothel at that time, run by Scotty Bowers.
Yes. So there was like a trailer out back or something.
There were all sorts of venues where sex could take place.
Bathrooms, trailers.
Yes. So he's quite an entrepreneur. He had a trailer in the back, which had two beds in it. And then there was a motel across the street. And then there was the bathroom. And not only was there the bathroom, but he had drilled a peephole. So he would charge people a discount to just look through the peephole at what was happening in the bathroom.
Did everybody know that you could potentially be watched?
I doubt it. But really, he invented the drive-through brothel, which is perfect for Los Angeles. He's sort of the Ray Kroc of prostitution.
Yeah, fast service. He does talk about turning tricks himself. Mm-hmm. And then he also, certain people said they never paid. He would arrange these rendezvous. Mm-hmm. I mean, the premise clearly in the film is that he is doing a service by helping people who are gay mm-hmm. and have to be in the closet to lead a life with, a full life that includes sex and not just pretending to be a straight person.
In the period, which is in the post-World War II era, the studio contracts had morals clauses in them, which prevented people who were gay or bisexual from being open about their sexuality. Of course, society was very closed as well, but there was a special extra punitive angle to it in Hollywood, because if you were Cary Grant and you were dating Randolph Scott, which was the case, if that became public knowledge, you would be ruined. And Scotty, through this very benign form of prostitution and pimping, if you will, although he's such a nice guy, pimp seems so sinister,
it's
doesn't
a
really
harsh
fit
word.
Him well, but would create really what we today call a safe place. And it seems ironic to say that because you don't think of houses of prostitution necessarily as a safe place. But in that era in this town, the movie stars and a lot of people who work for the studios were just prevented contractually for living their authentic lives. And he made these arrangements for them in the most genteel way, really. And what you're getting at about the financials is that he's unabashed about having been a sex worker, a prostitute. He was a male prostitute. He was proud of it. He took money for prostitution.
Although
and it was,
he's clearly not only – he's an omnisexual.
Yeah, pansexual, omnisexual. He doesn't really identify as gay. He's kind of a no-labels person before his time. And in terms of the fixing people up, what he's saying when he says, I never took a dime of anyone's money, is that the normal process is the so-called pimp takes a cut, and he mm-hmm. never did.
It's kind of a funny thing because you were talking about he gave them this dignified opportunity to express themselves, and it's in a gas station. You know, not the setting you would think of for dignity, but yet it still is a way of giving people some dignity.
L.A. was such a weird combination then of sophisticated, wealthy, and honky-tonk, and the car culture is being born. The freeway goes right by the gas station, but it didn't exist when Scotty started there. So I think this whole narrative is very emblematic of the city. He himself has told me that this could only happen in LA the way it happened. Geographically, you had to drive across the city. A lot of the studios were on the east side or in the valley. So you would pass this gas station on your way home to Beverly Hills or Pacific Palisades or wherever you lived in your big mansion. You lived your sort of bourgeois public existence, but you could stop and get in trouble at this gas station. And again, it's a car culture. It's a car city. So everyone had to stop to get gas anyway. why not have some add-ons? and there was definitely a market for it.
Clean your windshield and whatever.
That's kind of how it worked also. You could also do takeout, so to speak. So the guy would pretend to wash your windows. And then, as Scotty explained it to me, he'd then wash the inside of the windows. And then he's already halfway in the car. And then he'd shut the door and you'd speed off with him and then maybe drive him back to the gas station later.
Yeah. And the community, of course, it is the milieu in which this could happen. So he has made the point, I think, that he's only doing this because the people he's discussing are dead.
He says that he wanted to wait until everyone was gone before he did this. So this is sort of like an unspoken gentleman's agreement in his eyes. This raises other issues, of course,
right,
such as why'd you wait till everyone was dead? Because then it becomes harder to prove. And
well, also you're outing someone posthumously.
Yes. The outing debate is interesting to look at. It's a sort of a 90s origin story, outing.
You think outing is dead?
Well, Scotty actually says it better than anyone, I think, when he's confronted by a fan, I guess, who's buying his book at a book signing.
He's in the film. Mm-hmm.
And he raises the issue that you've just raised, which is, don't you feel culpable for outing these people when they're dead? And then the man goes on to say, what if some grandkid says, oh, my grandfather was gay? And Scotty then says, what's wrong with being gay?
Right.
I think we're more in that place now than we were in the 90s, where outing was politicized. It was used kind of like a political tool in the ACT UP era.
But we both know of people who are quite well known, very well known, mm-hmm. who are in the closet right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm not someone that in my own journalism has outed people.
Neither have I. I understand Scotty's message, which is what's your problem if people are gay? Mm-hmm. But I also see the other side of the coin a little bit of, well, if I'm gay and I choose to be in the closet, is that not my choice, you know?
Yeah, I think when you're looking at old Hollywood and the studio system, which is one of the major historical themes of the 20th century, and the essence of that studio system was a dream factory and myth-making machine. Mm-hmm. And because those myths are still with us, and the tent poles of those myths are in the person of Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, this book shatters a lot of illusions. If you want to think that Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn had a lifelong love affair or something, you're going to have to let that one go.
Yeah, so I think that that's really the context. Should we not know more about a historical figure, Cary Grant's private life? Would a biographer, a responsible biographer, in my opinion, not get into that? So I think Scotty really fits into that category. And I think a lot of people want to dismiss him as a kind of creep. They call him a pimp, and pimp has bad connotations. If you meet him, he's almost this magical, benign type of being.
Very sort of sunny personality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Who really, everyone I spoke to about him who met him decades and decades ago speaks about him in glowing terms, that he was a very helpful person. I think that he is a great contributor to the historical record about a very important period. And the narrative of that period is about layers of mythology. And I think we should understand what went into making that mythology and the truth behind a lot of those myths is very different than the one that we were sold and persists, which I think is one of the remarkable things about it, is that the image of Cary Grant is such a powerful image that many people have confronted me in the course of making the film to say, you're ruining my image of Cary Grant. Please don't do this. And I find that fascinating, really.
Well, as a straight woman, I will admit that one hurts.
Well, it mostly comes from straight women. But this is why I think the movie was an interesting project to pursue. Why do you feel that way? And what's that say?
Because it's the fantasy, like, oh, me and Cary Grant, except he's not interested.
Yeah, but that says so much about old Hollywood and the classic Hollywood films, which still affect our lives in a surprising way, even though they're the better part of 100 years old. So I think unpacking the dynamics of that myth and the mechanics of the myth machine, I think, is a valid thing to do. And I think Scotty's a big part of substantiating these claims that go into that demystification.
Coming up after a short break, Matt Turnauer tells us what 95-year-old Scotty Bowers believes is the key to a long life. You'll never guess. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Matt Turnauer, director of the new documentary, Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. The film is now playing in L.A. and will open in more theaters in the coming weeks. Scotty is Scotty Bowers, a pansexual nonagenarian who for decades, starting in the 1940s, was a fixer for gay and bisexual stars looking for discreet hookups. He also turned tricks himself.
I fixed Katharine Hepburn up with every bit of 150 girls. I've been with Barry Grant, Rock Hudson, Charles Laughton at Frank Sinatra's house. I had a three-way with Ava Gardner and Lana Turner.
Filmmaker Matt Turnauer wanted to examine the mores of the era that kept celebrities in the closet and explore the mystery that is Scotty himself. Now, into the psychology of Scotty, there are a couple of things that, you know, are arresting. One is that he is a ferocious hoarder. How did that strike you? I mean, were you surprised to find that out? I mean, he does sort of signify some embarrassment at times when you film it. Like, I know it's a lot of stuff over here or whatever. Yeah. I mean, a lot of stuff.
Yeah. He's such an authentic person. I didn't know he was a hoarder when we started out. And one of the producers went up to scout his house, one of his houses, because he had a few. He has a few. And he said, oh, we won't be able to film in it because it's basically a storage unit. And I thought, oh, that's odd. And so I went up there and I thought, oh, my God. He's a major hoarder. And you know what? I'm a neat freak. I throw everything out. I love minimalism. But don't judge, especially when I'm doing a story or a film. And I think there's been a consistency in my work over the years where I let people tell their own story and I let the reader or the viewer make their own judgment. So I wasn't about to judge him for that. I find it's very common among viewers of the film. People get hung up on the hoarding and they get judgy about it. And I'm not sure exactly why. I think the judgment in the viewer signifies a few reactions.
Yeah, I hardly see it as a thing to judge. It's more like the psychological puzzle of what makes this guy who he is.
Yes.
Like, how does that fit in is the question that I don't have any answer.
Well, his wife comments on it.
Right.
She says at one point, I'm sure the war did this to him. Now, he was a Marine in World War II in the Pacific, and he was in at least four of the worst battles. So he has major PTSD. He doesn't refer to it as PTSD because he's of the generation where that wasn't a thing. So
right.
He's a Marine to the end, which is another fascinating aspect of his personality. You don't think gay, Marine.
I actually kind of love that. Yeah.
I mean, all these things are wonderful contradictions
right.
that make up the hidden history of the second half of the 20th century. We have these images of the way people should be. And the tough Marine that fought in Bougainville
right.
in World War II shouldn't be a gay prostitute on Hollywood Boulevard. Well, you know what? He was. But that's not all there is to it.
Right.
I think a lot of people just don't want to be a hoarder because it's messy. But you know what? Life's messy. And his story is not tidy. And the film shows a lot of that.
And of course, also, I'll mention, you know, he was a child who was sexually abused, but he does not see it that way whatsoever. He sees it as something he did voluntarily and enthusiastically, which is another thing. It's kind of part of the mystery of his personality and what goes into creating a person of his nature, you know, who's this bundle of somewhat contradictions. And, you know, he's an interesting character and all of those things go into the makeup.
Yeah, first-class survivor. And I don't think it's any wonder that Dr. Kinsey studied him.
He was studied by Dr. Kinsey. I know. That's a touch, I'll tell you.
I called the Kinsey Institute, and they said, oh, yeah, one of the biggest files in the file cabinet, Scotty Bowers. And all of that stuff is under a covenant of confidentiality. So it wasn't really available.
Which he couldn't waive even.
Even he couldn't waive it. That's the way it was done. And you can understand why Kinsey would need to assure his subjects of that. But Kinsey studied him as one of these 360-degree sexual unicorns.
Which he is certainly one of those, yeah. So I don't know if you reached a conclusion when he tells you that I had sex when I was like 11, I think he was 11 years old. I mean, did you ever say, well, you know, dude, that's not okay? Or did you just let him say it is okay?
Well, in the film, I question him in the form of saying, well, you thought that was okay.
Yes.
And he assures me that he did vehemently. Right. Now, you can't extrapolate that he thinks it would be good for everybody because I don't think he does. And in fact, he told me off camera that he doesn't. But he believes very firmly that for him, he was a sexualized being at this shockingly early age. And he says at another time in the film, where I also push him on it and say, people really, when they see this, are going to think that what you did was wrong and that you were traumatized. And he says, I was not traumatized. And that's his position. And I believe, as the filmmaker who's making an observational cinema verite film, that it's not my responsibility to then lay into him or to interview a psychiatrist. I think that he's telling you how he feels and he's sticking to it. And he has a particular point of view and opinion about it. I think we need to meet people like that in narratives. I don't think that we should hide people's opinions, even if they're controversial and they're horrifying to us. So he's that person, and he's rare in many respects,
yeah,
for better or worse.
Sure. Yeah. At this point, he's 90 what? He's
95, just turned 95.
Now, he's quite fit. He's really shockingly fit. I thought, well, maybe the key to this kind of longevity is just wild orgies constantly.
He would agree with that.
Yeah.
I will note that he was enormously promiscuous at a very dangerous time for promiscuity and survived that as well. I'm referring, of course, to the HIV-AIDS crisis, and he does not contract HIV, presumably, and is alive to tell his tale. He was not just a sex worker, though. He was a worker. I mean, he was the man of all work for a lot of people. And this is, seems like a minor note, but it's really actually significant because other people who are doubters have said to me, well, you know, he claims to have been very close friends with George Cukor, who was the king of Hollywood, one of the kings of Hollywood, and certainly the king of gay Hollywood. And Cole Porter, who was another major gay icon.
And
who
very
lived.
Energetic with it.
Yes. He reveals Cole Porter had a large sexual appetite. But doubters have said, well, you know, these sophisticated men, they wouldn't want to hang around with this grease monkey who worked in a gas station. Well, I actually beg to differ. I think not only was he very handsome and apparently very talented sexually, he brought other men over, which is apparently what these guys were in the mood for, but he would also fix the plumbing. If the light in the closet was out, he would do the wiring. He would trim the trees. He dug ditches for swimming. He dug swimming pools by hand. I mean, he was really an essential character for, if you will, the carriage trade of Hollywood in this period. And he was a very known. He was also a bartender and did all of the grand parties, especially in the gay scene. So he's really an icon. And I think the movie, I think, is important to bring to light that there was this character who existed in the shadows, who was a major pillar of the community.
And his health now at 95?
Oh, yeah. So all of this physical activity, I think, has paid off because when I met him, he was 90, and he was the most fit 90-year-old climbing ladders, climbing trees, trimming trees on ladders with chainsaws. He started to have some health problems. He has a kidney problem that's brought on, weirdly, by a World War II malaria medication he took. So there's a lot of echoes of that
past trauma.
20th mm-hmm. century past. He's really like the 20th century boy.
Surviving him well into the 21st, yeah.
But he's doing well, and I'm so happy that he's out promoting the film.
He's
alive,
like,
see his movie premiere.
Well, I assume he likes the film.
He does like the film. He's a man of few words. Sometimes I asked him what he thought, and he said, the music's peppy and the words are peppy too. He had a two-line critique.
Matt Turnauer is the director of Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.